Greetings and Christmastide tintabulations, my metaphorically retro-tastic listeners, and welcome to this December 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this biliously psychotic science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Ha ha ha! Every time you think you've run out of idiot scientists of the month, the universe provides. I've got a doozy for you this month. The scientific community exploded several weeks ago when idiot Chinese scientist Dr. He Jiankui announced he'd successfully used CRISPR gene editing technology on twin girls, tweaking a gene to make them resistant to HIV. Did they have HIV? No. Did their mother have HIV? No. Well, their father had HIV, but that didn't mean that the twin girls needed to become resistant to HIV. Anyway, he said the experiment, which hasn't yet been peer-reviewed or overseen in any way by any private or governmental agency, and was immediately denounced as unethical by most of his at least sane peers around the world, made him, quote-unquote, proud. Of course, he did not mention or seem to care that in the last couple of weeks, there have been a whole slew of recent studies into CRISPR technology and its dangers. The studies have found that gene editing can trigger cancer, which we already knew or suspected, or, I love this one, wipe out randomly huge chunks of DNA in a genome that weren't targeted. Oops! Anyway, Dr. He's leap forward has brought a huge oversight into focus. There is no international regulatory framework governing the use of CRISPR technology, and many countries rely on scientists to self-regulate. Now, in essence, this is not a bad thing. Genetic engineering has been in existence since the late 70s, and the process of self-governing has worked pretty well. We've had no serious issues with scientists going off the rails and creating some genetically engineered supervirus that threatens the whole world, despite what a lot of SF writers have speculated about over the last 40 years. But this is different. We're talking about technology with the potential to literally change the human race from what it is now to something very different. Now, some are questioning whether self-governing of scientists is enough, especially when the good Dr. He says a third genetically edited baby may be on the way. I love that, by the way, may be on the way. Lots of geneticists and others are condemning Dr. He as irresponsible and unethical. Unfortunately, at least the Chinese public may not agree. A recent survey of about 5,000 people in China found that 60% of them support the research into the application of human gene editing technology to treat diseases. Now, I've described CRISPR before, but let me do it again, either for newcomers or those who have forgotten. CRISPR is an acronym for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, which actually doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot in and of itself, but we won't go there. These sequences were originally discovered in bacteria as chunks of recurring DNA that defend against viral infection. Geneticists co-opted this system because it has the ability to cut open DNA and allow it to be edited. Now, normally the term CRISPR is short for CRISPR-Cas. Cas is the associated protein that slices through the DNA and actually allows the editing. With the CRISPR to guide the complex to a target and the Cas enzyme to sniff out particular specific genes, it's a pretty powerful combination. Many in the medical community hope that this can offer a workable way to fight against gene-based disorders like sickle cell anemia and cystic fibrosis. But editing genes can have unintended consequences, not just for the edited embryo, but for their descendants if that edited gene is passed on. There has been near universal condemnation of Dr. He and his gene-editing human embryos outside of the scrutiny of regulatory bodies. When the news broke about his work, more than 100 scientists signed a petition immediately calling for greater oversight. The Chinese government reiterated that gene editing of human embryos for reproductive purposes is banned in their country, and they condemned him too. Yes, we're talking about a still tyrannical communist government reminding Dr. He
that what he did was illegal even in China, where just about anything has been acceptable for the last 50 years when it comes to genetic experiments. But some scientists are advancing CRISPR research in what may be more morally palatable ways, like editing adult genes to help alleviate diseases. Patients with Hunter syndrome, for example, have shown promise after undergoing gene editing treatment, which allows their livers to produce an enzyme that curbs the disease. By the way, this is not an easy way of doing things, and there are a limited number of diseases that can be ameliorated by CRISPR in adults. Besides Hunter syndrome, some excellent work has been done directing new pigment-producing genes into the retina to alleviate color blindness, but again, there are very few genetic diseases that can be treated this way. I spent quite a bit of time in my genetics class trying to explain why. I think that the scientists who believe that diseases like muscular dystrophy and Huntington's may be cured by CRISPR in adults have a very pie-in-the-sky attitude. They are way too hopeful, and I do not believe it will ever occur. I mean, we have trillions of cells in our bodies, and there are just way too many technical issues. Unless something is very targeted, it won't be easy to fix. Anyway, let's go on to a real story that is actually kind of related to the idiot scientist, insofar as it concerns mucking around where humans probably don't have much business mucking around. So, the first baby has been born following a uterine transplantation from a deceased donor. This news has been reported in a case study from Brazil, published in the journal The Lancet. The study is also the first uterine transplantation in Latin America, which I guess was very successful. The new findings demonstrate that uterine transplants from deceased donors are feasible, and it may open up access for all women with uterine infertility without the need for live donors. However, the outcomes and effects of donations from live and deceased donors are yet to be compared, and the surgical and immunosuppression techniques will have to be optimized in the future. So in this case, the recipient of the transplant was a patient with uterine infertility. Previously, there had been 10 other uterine transplants from deceased donors attempted in the U.S., the Czech Republic, and Turkey, but none of them took, and this was the first to actually result in a live birth. The first childbirth followed uterine transplantation from living donors, and that occurred in Sweden in 2013. And that was also published in The Lancet. In total, there have been about 39 procedures of this kind since 2013. And so far, it's resulted in 11 live births, which is not bad out of 39. So Dr. Donny Eschenberg, Universidad de Sao Paulo Medical School, led the study and says, quote, "The use of deceased donors could greatly broaden access to this treatment, and our results provide proof of concept for a new option for women with uterine infertility. The first uterus transplants from live donors were a medical milestone, creating the possibility of childbirth for many infertile women with access to suitable donors and the needed medical facilities. However, the need for a live donor is a major limitation, as donors are rare, typically being willing and eligible family members or close relatives. The numbers of people willing and committed to donate organs upon their own deaths are far larger than those of live donors, offering a much wider potential donor population," unquote. The surgery from the article took place in September 2016. Yeah, it takes a couple of years for medical news to circulate. The recipient of the uterus was a 32-year-old woman born without a uterus as a result of Meyer-Rakotansky Kusterhauser syndrome. Wow. Now, there is a disease that I actually talk about in my medical genetics class all the time. MRKH sufferers not only lack a uterus, but they usually lack a vaginal canal as well. I've heard some less than respectful MDs refer to this as Barbie doll syndrome because of the lack of genitalia. It's really not very respectful or nice. So this transplant recipient had in vitro fertilization induced 4 months before the transplant, resulting in 8 fertilized eggs, which were then cryopreserved. this must have been done in part by surgery because, again, most MRKH sufferers don't have access to their reproductive organs from the outside. So the uterine donor was 45 years old and died of stroke. The uterus was removed from the donor and then transplanted into the recipient. The surgery was about 10 hours long, and it involved connecting the donor's uterus and the recipient's veins and arteries and ligaments and vaginal canal. So after the surgery, the recipient stayed in intensive care for 2 days and then spent 6 days on a specialized transplant ward. She received 5 different immunosuppression drugs, antibiotics, anti-blood clotting medicine, aspirin, and she continued the immunosuppression when she left the hospital. So 5 months after transplantation, the uterus showed no signs of rejection, and the ultrasound showed no anomalies, so they decided to go ahead with the transplantation. This is just amazing to me. I mean, now I have a real story to tell my genetics class. So the fertilized eggs were implanted after 7 months. The authors note that they were able to implant the fertilized eggs into the transplant uterus much earlier than previous uterus transplants, which typically occurred about a year after transplantation. Implantation was planned to be at 6 months, but the endometrium wasn't thick enough at that stage, so it was postponed for a month. 10 days after implantation, the recipient was confirmed to be pregnant. Non-invasive prenatal testing was done at 10 weeks, showing a normal fetus, and ultrasound scans at 10 and 20 weeks revealed no fetal anomalies, and there were no issues during the recipient's pregnancy. Her baby girl was born via cesarean section at 35 weeks and 3 days, and weighed about 6 pounds, or about 2,500 grams. So, according to the article, the transplanted uterus was removed during the cesarean section and showed no anomalies. I'm not sure whether this was because it was a one-shot deal, or because the recipient only wanted one baby, or because it was a risk to leave the uterus behind, or I don't know. They don't say. They do say that both the recipient and the baby were discharged after 3 days, with an uneventful follow-up. The immunosuppression therapy was just suspended, I mean, because of the hysterectomy. I mean, she had the uterus removed, so she didn't really need the immunosuppression anymore. So at the age of 7 months and 20 days, when the story was actually written, the baby was breastfeeding and weighed about 15 pounds, or about 7 kilograms. The authors note that the transplant involved major surgery, and recipients for uterus transplants would need to be healthy to avoid complications. They also note that the surgery used high doses of immunosuppression, which could be reduced in the future if they do more studies. It also involved moderate levels of blood loss, although these were manageable. The whole story is just amazing to me because this is the first time that a dead donor has given part of their reproductive system. I'm still trying to decide whether this is a step forward or a step back or what. Not at least the poor woman with the MRKH beat the odds and actually had a baby of her own, which is just amazing. Next story. Redheads. Can they actually suck your soul from your body? All right, it's just a rumor. Just kidding. But this story actually does have something to do with redheads. So, although I have dark hair, I'm a heterozygote for red hair and carry the trait. Well, my hair isn't quite dark anymore. It's salt and pepper, as it's so quaintly called. My wife is also a heterozygote for red hair and has brown hair with red highlights. Just as a quick reminder, if you are a heterozygote, you have a copy of a recessive and a copy of a dominant trait. The dominant trait in this case is for dark hair. And no, neither of our kids have red hair, although many of their cousins did as babies, and several still do. Why do I bring this up? Well, apparently, it is a fairly complex genetic pathway for a child to get red hair. It's not quite as simple as a genetics textbook would have you believe. Well, so how complicated is it? Dr. Ian Jackson of the University of Edinburgh decided to get to the roots of the issue. All right, yes, pun intended. His research group mapped the genes responsible for hair color among the UK biobank participants. Now, that is a population of nearly 350,000 people. Previously, variations in a single gene called MC1R were thought to be decisive in whether you got red hair or not. But Jackson's study has made it clear that there are other genetic factors that interact with MC1R to determine whether one's locks will be ginger or something else. Comparing redheads to people with brown hair or black hair, Jackson identified 8 previously unknown genetic differences that are associated with red hair. His group also looked at the functions of the genes they identified, found that some of them work by controlling when MC1R is switched on and off. All this work is described in the December issue of the journal Nature Communications. Besides identifying 8 additional variants that explain most of the single nucleotide polymorphisms that account for red hair heritability, the study found that more than 200 genetic variants are independently associated with multiple hair colors on the spectrum of blonde to black. A single nucleotide polymorphism is a single base pair difference in a long sequence. The long important sequence, generally a sequence that expresses something, but it doesn't necessarily have to. Jackson says in the article, quote, MC1R explains only 73% of the heritability for red hair in the UK biobank, and in fact, most individuals with 2 MC1R variants have blonde or light brown hair. We identify other genes contributing to red hair, the combined effect of which accounts for about 90% of heritability. Unquote. Also detailed in the article were the differences in the 200 genes associated with blondes and brunettes. The researchers were surprised to find that many of these 200 genetic differences were associated with hair texture rather than pigmentation. The others are involved in determining how the hair grows, curly or straight. So this finding, the scientists pointed out, emphasizes the importance of the keratinocyte versus melanocyte interactions in the determination of hair pigmentation and the impact of hair shape on color perception. Keratinocytes are the cells in the hair that make the major protein keratin, and the melanocytes make the melanin pigment, which gives it its color. Jackson finishes with, quote, we were able to use the power of the UK Biobank, a huge and unique genetic study of 500,000 people in Britain, which allowed us to find these effects. It has provided some fascinating insights into what makes us such distinct individuals, unquote. And yes, if you are thinking that this is more information to be used by reckless scientists like the infamous Dr. He, yes, it is! We're getting closer and closer to being able to edit every aspect of the human zygote. I find the entire likelihood of this utterly terrifying. So let's stick with our evening's theme of human genetics. One of my students clued me in a couple of weeks ago to this story in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. I had apparently missed it entirely. It has to do with mitochondria and genetic inheritance. So for the last 30 years, scientists have thought that children inherited mitochondria exclusively from their mothers, since mitochondria from the father's sperm are usually, well, destroyed after the egg is fertilized. The nucleus of our cells has most of the DNA we inherited from both mom and dad. However, the mitochondria does have DNA of its own, and that contains some of the genes needed for building and running the organelle. So, previous data has suggested that when you look at the DNA in a mitochondria, it's going to be of maternal genetic descent, and not from the father's side. Anyone who has their DNA analyzed by companies like 23andMe or the others knows that these places link your maternal DNA markers going back in time through the mitochondria. And if you're a female, well, and don't have a Y chromosome, you have a very difficult time, if not an impossible time, tracking back paternal data. Well, Dr. Paldeep Atwal of the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, I didn't know there was a Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, but anyway, he published new research in the November 26th issue, PNAS, that suggests that in rare cases, dads can contribute mitochondria too. For now, the consequences of inheriting mitochondria from both parents aren't really known. Atwell spotted the paternal signature after examining DNA from a woman who came into the Mayo Clinic South. The woman's cells weirdly contained 2 types of mitochondrial DNA, some from Mom, and some from quote-unquote somewhere else. Thinking the result was a mistake, Otwell and his colleagues repeated the test, and Otwell says, quote, "The same result came back the second time. That's when we started to get a little suspicious," unquote. The researchers had DNA from both of the woman's parents. The team examined the father's mitochondrial DNA and found that he was the source of the mystery mitochondria. The woman's brother also inherited mitochondria from their father. So Otwell got in touch with another researcher by the name of Dr. Daosheng Wong, a mitochondrial disease expert at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. And it turns out that Wong had examined patients from two other families in which fathers had handed mitochondria down to their children. Altogether, the researchers found 17 people in three families who had inherited 24% to 76% of their mitochondria from dad. Everyone agrees this is not going to be a very common event. Already, there's speculation as to how it may have happened. But one of the best hypotheses, suggested by Wong, is that in a few rare cases, the biological system that normally is slated to destroy the paternal mitochondria fails, leaving some of dad's mitochondria to multiply. You guys may have heard of the so-called three-parent babies, and these are children whose mitochondria come from donor eggs because their mother's eggs carry mitochondrial diseases. Well, in the future, we may be able to stop this type of stopgap reproduction. If the mitochondria from the father can actually do the job and be induced to get inherited, well, then maybe we can stick with the two-parent baby situation that's been standard for time immemorial. Okay, let's get away from genetics. In fact, let's get away from biology entirely. Let's talk about something completely different. Volcanoes. According to an article published this month in the journal Science, the eruptions of the Hawaiian Big Island volcano Kilauea have finally stopped for the moment. I saw Kilauea 2 years ago at Volcano National Park, and I was kind of disappointed. Lots of steam. The crater was kind of glowy, but there was no lava. I wanted lava. Okay, I only had to wait 2 years to get lava when Kilauea exploded several months back during the summer, and it hasn't stopped for quite a while. It's been spewing huge amounts of lava ever since. Would have liked to have seen it in person, though. Anyway, now Kilauea, the world's longest continuously erupting volcano, finally seems to have taken a break, for which I'm sure the citizens of the Big Island are grateful. Dr. Kyle Anderson, the main author on that Science article and a geophysicist with the U.S. Geologic Survey, says, quote, "The latest eruption started in May. By the time it had ended 3 months later, over 825 million cubic meters of earth had collapsed at the summit. That's the equivalent of 300,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools." One of the most amazing things that came out of the eruption was a better understanding of how calderas collapse. The caldera is the crater of the volcano covered by a layer of rock, and presumably underneath that is lava, or magma, or whichever it is. It was not huge. The entire caldera was not huge when I saw it a couple years ago. It may be a half mile across. Well, that has changed. The collapsed caldera now looks like the Grand Canyon relative to what it was. Scientists previously believed that groundwater plays a big role in how a caldera collapses when craters are drained of their magma. Okay, Anderson says, quote, "Cooling and cracking depressurized the caldera, allowing groundwater to seep in and create a series of explosive eruptions. But groundwater did not play a significant role in driving the explosions this summer. Instead, the destruction of Kilauea's crater is what's called a piston-style caldera collapse. 62 small collapse events rattled the volcano from mid-May to late August, and with each collapse causing the crater to sink and push the surrounding land out and up. By the end, the crater of the volcano sank as much as 500 meters. That's more than the height of the Empire State Building," unquote. Another surprising result of the Kilauea study suggests that life can endure even in the most heinous of circumstances. Under the sea near the volcano, life moved in and around the brand new land surprisingly quickly. Using a remotely operated vehicle to explore the seafloor, researchers found evidence of hydrothermal activity along newly deposited lava flows about 650 meters down. More surprising, bright yellow, potentially iron-oxidizing microbes had already moved in. Anderson says that, quote, "This discovery suggests how volcanism can give rise to the chemical energy that can drive primitive microbial organisms and flower a whole ecosystem," unquote. Observations from previous eruptions suggest that the next phase of Kilauea's volcanic cycle will probably be quieter, but the volcano likely won't stay quiet. Anderson says that we're in a lull right now and we just don't know what is going to happen next. Anderson and other scientists are also watching the volcano next door, Mauna Loa. History has shown that Mauna Loa can act up during periods when Kilauea sleeps. For the past several years, volcanologists have kept an eye on Kilauea's larger sister volcano. Anderson finishes with, quote, "We're seeing a little bit of inflation at Mauna Loa and some earthquake swarms where it has been active. So that's another issue of concern for us going into the future," unquote. Now, I was told when I was in Hawaii that if Mauna Loa erupts, lava flows could take out $1 billion of real estate along the coast where the city of Kona resides. It would be many times worse than where Kilauea erupted because there are more towns, more people, and many resorts. I saw the end results of the last time Mauna Loa went off in the late 1800s, and that is miles and miles and miles of lava fields along the Kona coast. All right, last story of the evening. I just watched the trailer for the new Godzilla movie, Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And toward the end of the trailer, I noticed something very interesting, and probably more than a bit wrong in terms of science and reality. Godzilla is rushing toward the three-headed monster called King Ghidorah, and he is moving with serious speed, like a lion or a tiger just running very quickly. The only problem is that Godzilla is 30 stories tall, at least, in this movie. He's huge. There's no way that he can move that fast, given his enormous bulk. The cube square law describes the relationship between the volume and surface area as a shape's size increases or decreases. Basically, it's the idea that if something is made bigger by some ratio, the cross-sectional area increases as the square of the ratio, but its weight increases by the cube of the ratio. So the ability of the thing to support its own weight gets worse and worse as it gets bigger and bigger. This is why the Brontosauri in Jurassic Park walked so slowly and rather nobly and had legs around as big as tanker trucks. And it looked natural to us because it is unlikely that they would have moved much faster than that. Now, we have Godzilla, pictured, who's at least 10 times bigger than any Brontosaurus, moving at a speed which is simply unlikely, as one can imagine. Now, I actually have a science story related to size and speed that was released this month in the Journal of the Proceedings of the Royal Society B from the lab of Drs. Heather Moore and Max Donnellan from Simon Fraser University in Canada. So, life is full of surprises, especially if you're Godzilla. And for any animal in the wild, surprises could cost dearly. Lurking predators might attack. Rough terrain could turn every step into a precarious balancing act. You could be attacked by Mothra or Rodan. Anyway, an animal's ability to quickly sense trouble and respond accordingly is crucial. Given that neural information must travel longer distances than larger animals, how do larger animals cope with these apparently longer delays? Moore and Donnellan decided to find out by studying how the size of an animal influences the delay between sensing and then generating movement. Based on the cube square law, bigger animals should be much slower to react. But we're talking about how fast their nervous system is going to work here. And the question is, are the two connected? So to study the delay between sensing and movement, the team decided to study the stretch reflex, the animal's equivalent to the human knee-jerk reflex. The stretch reflex maintains favored muscle lengths by sensing length changes to the muscle and correcting that length accordingly. The reflex can be broken down into a series of events and analyzed. Donnellan and Moore had studied the reflex in a range of terrestrial animals, but to test their new hypothesis, they searched the scientific literature to include stretch reflex delays from more animals, spanning a 5-gram shrew to a 5,000-kilogram elephant. Plotting animal size against total reflex delay, Moore and Donnellan found that the delay strongly increased with animal size. A shrew has a 10-millisecond delay compared with an elephant's 180-millisecond delay. That's an 18-fold increase in delay across the size range. Now, to understand why the reflex delay got longer with size, the team took a closer look at the time course of the signal's path from the stretch sensors and back to the muscle, and found that the large animal's longer nerve fibers spanning their longer limbs mainly explain the longer delays. I'm not going to say duh, but well, duh. In contrast, other portions of the reflex's path, such as the time it took the stretch sensors to generate the electrical signal, and the time it took the electrical signal to cross between the nerve fibers and from the nerve fiber to the muscle, remained about 1 millisecond, and therefore were pretty much negligible. So this showed that the total delay increases were correlated pretty much with animal size, despite partial delays not scaling uniformly with size. Next, the team calculated reflex delay relative to the contact time of the animal's legs with the ground to account for the larger animal's slower movement. As the larger animals move more slowly, their reflex delay expressed as a percentage of the animal's contact time did not increase 18-fold across the entire 5-gram to 5,000-kilogram size range. It only doubled. That means that larger animals benefit from their slower movements because long movement times accommodate their longer delays. In other words, if they move faster, they wouldn't be able to use the reflex information to correct their movement. So Godzilla and King Ghidorah should both not only be moving more slowly, but reacting more slowly so their movements can be altered as needed. Perhaps the producers of the new Godzilla movie should have considered filming the whole thing in slow motion, as one would expect with animals the size of buildings. Well, that's all from me for now. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. React slowly enough so you don't trip over your own feet. Don't count on designer babies very soon unless you live in China. Keep watching the skies. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.